Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 12th, 1999, and in Koinonia Fireside Room this afternoon is Ralph Milton's session called Adventures in Faith, number 99-9. Let's listen in.
Love, deep love. Yahweh loved making things, round things like worlds, and growing things like dandelions, and creeping things like worms, and things that walked and ran. It was fun, too. Yahweh raced with the gazelle, and of course won hands down, because Yahweh was God, and therefore the best at everything. And Yahweh made faces at the chimp, and the chimp really broke up laughing, because God could make funnier faces than anyone. But the gazelles and the chimps and all the other animals were mostly concerned with necessary things like eating and copulating and bearing offspring. In those days, the animals could talk, and Yahweh had interesting conversations with them, interesting and sometimes frustrating. There were two words the animals never used. What if? Yahweh used those two words constantly. What if, instead of having babies come out of eggs, we grew them inside their mother's womb? None of the animals could understand that.
I laid a 200-pound egg last week, said the elephant. I was going for a record, and now you decide to change it.
Well, what if you had a 300-pound baby instead, Yahweh asked, and it'd be ready to go. You wouldn't have to sit on it for 16 months.
I suppose, but we never did it that way before, said the elephant.
The birds and the insects and the reptiles seemed to be the most conservative of all. No way, Jose, said the blue jay. I like sitting on eggs. I like it. So all right already, said Yahweh. What if birds, insects, and reptiles did eggs, and the rest of you had the new, improved, ready-to-go kid? What if, said the baboon. Couldn't you leave things alone instead of creating all the time? No, I can't. That's who I am, said Yahweh. You're a survivor, I'm a creator. And oh, how I'd like to have someone to create with me.
Here we go again, said the dinosaur.
What if, Yahweh said, kind of introspectively, what if I made something that's a little like both of us? A little like you animals and a little like me. And what if we called it a human? Yahweh God was silent for a while. Then, let us make a human in our image, a being that's going to be like you animals in all kinds of ways, an animal that can run like a gazelle and make stupid faces like a chimp, a being that will be preoccupied with necessary things like eating and copulating and bearing young and staying alive. Yahweh paused for a moment. But this being, this human, will be like me, too. This human will know what it is like to be God. This human will understand the difference between good and evil. This human will get the point of a joke. This human will understand the words, what if? So Yahweh God went to work. Yahweh took some of the dust of the ground, moistened it with the water of life, and shaped it into a beautiful creature called human. Then Yahweh held the new being close, like a mother cradling her baby, and gently breathed the breath of life into this new creation. And the human became a living soul. The animals gasped. The human was beautiful, just beautiful. Yahweh looked and smiled at the human. Behold, Yahweh said, this is very good. Yahweh and the human had a wonderful time together. Yahweh and the human loved to begin sentences with what if.
But some of the animals were much more logical than God. They pointed out a small flaw in the divine plan. And God, said the orangutan, you said this human was going to be like us animals, preoccupied with necessary things like eating and copulating. The eating part is no problem. The human manages to eat alone all right, but if you have a copulator, you also have to have a copulatee. Good point, said God, but I'll do you one better. This human is created in my image. The human is like me in the most important way possible. So this human will need more than just another human to copulate with and to bear offspring with. So God caused a deep sleep to fall on the first human, and from the side of one made another human, very much like the first, but different in just the right ways. Look, God said to the animals, these humans can do far more than copulate. When humans bring their bodies together in care and tenderness, they will know that one was taken from the other, and that one is incomplete without the other. They will know each other in love, and it will be a sacrament, a divine and holy sacrament. And these humans, out of their lovemaking, and because they will know sacredness in their loving, they will be able to create the world with me. Then the great God Yahweh looked at the two humans standing there, bare naked and beautiful. And God loved them and gave them names, Eve and Adam. And Yahweh smiled a smile as wide as the rainbow. Yahweh enjoyed creating with the humans, enjoyed the long what-if conversations they had strolling through the garden. But Yahweh was also a little bit worried. The humans were getting a little careless about their creating. It was just too easy to say what if and zap, there it was. Then Yahweh knew these humans were incomplete. Something was missing. It was fun creating with these humans, but they seemed so... God wasn't sure what. The garden was perfect. Everyone was having fun. But it didn't seem to mean anything. Suddenly, God said to the humans, I have a new question. It's even bigger than what if. And the question is, why?
I don't get it, said Adam.
Why? What do you mean, why? Asked Eve. There was a long pause. Finally, God said, what if... What if what? Asked Eve. Again, God was silent for a long while. Look, Eve, Adam, that tree over there, you can't eat any of the fruit off it, see? That's reserved for me. Touch it and I'll stomp on you good, you hear?
Whatever you say, shrugged Adam.
But why? Eve wanted to know, surprised that she was asking God's new question. Precisely, roared God. Now do as you're told. But Eve wondered. She almost thought she heard a challenge in Yahweh's order. Adam shrugged and walked off, but Eve sat down and looked at the tree, her eyes sparkling with the new challenge. Eve made up a tall tale about a serpent tempting her, just in case God should catch her red-handed. And then after dark one night, she snitched some of the fruit from the forbidden tree. And she slipped a few pieces into the salad Adam was making for supper. He never knew the difference. Yahweh, of course, knew the difference. After all, Yahweh was God. God knew everything. All right, said God, everybody out of the pool. You didn't play by the rules. You tried to think for yourselves. You tried to act on your own, so the party's over. Out. God sounded furious. But Eve thought she saw the hint of a smile in God's eyes. Or was it perhaps that God was shedding a divine tear?
Yahweh was both mother and father of the race of humans. Yahweh had enjoyed their childlike innocence, and it seemed like a shame for them to have to grow up so quickly. It was both a tear and a smile. Yahweh, like all parents, felt both joy and pain watching the kids go off into the world. So God put heavenly arms around the couple and gave them a hug. "You're going to have to work for your food," God said to them, somewhat sadly. "But the work will build strength. Work will put you in touch with the earth from which you were formed. And you are going to know pain and danger and anger and alienation and shame and heartbreak." Even Adam could feel that great heavenly body quake. God was crying. "I'm sorry it has to be this way," Yahweh said to them very softly. "But if you don't know about pain and danger and alienation and shame, you'll never know about joy and comfort and love and community and ecstasy. And death too. You've got to die so that you can live." "But why?" Eve asked. "You will never understand," said Yahweh. "But if you remember how we created this world together and how much I love you, then sometimes, just for an instant, you will know." So Adam and Eve went off to start the human race. And Yahweh grinned and cried at their naked buttocks bouncing away from paradise and into the world. "Be fruitful and multiply," God said. "Fill the earth. You're in charge of it. Be gentle with our creation." As the couple turned for one final wave, God called out, "Don't forget to call home often, please." So what do you think about that? Anybody offended? Anybody puzzled? Anybody concerned?
Entertaining.
Is that all? If you go into the library and you find there's a couple of copies in there of a book by Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers. And one of the mythic themes that they talk about all the time, over and over again, is the theme of the quest. Now, first of all, I need to explain again the word myth, because it is so misunderstood. And so many people take the word myth to mean something that is not true. And that is almost the polar opposite of what it really means, at least how it's used when storytellers and mythologists and others use the word. A myth is a story that contains deep and fundamental meaning, deep significance. And so a myth is any story that tells you who you are and what God expects you to do. Americans have all kinds of mythology around the War of Independence and the Boston Tea Party and so forth. Just look at your dollar bill and the triangle and all the symbolism of that myth that's on there. The founding fathers were mostly Masons, who have a wide and broad kind of mythology. And in fact, the American dream of the Horatio Alger idea of the one who can climb up the ladder, the noble poor man who can climb up the ladder and become president, is part of the mythology. It's a mythology that is sometimes very workable and sometimes very oppressive. Mythology does not necessarily need to be the opposite of history. Things can be very historical and still be mythological. The story, the myth of Martin Luther King, Jr. I mean, he has become greater since his death than he was in his life. There is a whole lot of stuff that has come around, and the story of his achievements and his work and so forth are part of the mythology because there's something deeply meaningful there for you. Well, that is grounded in history. I mean, I know, I've seen the man. So, anyway, what I'm saying is, look at myth with me this way, as stories that contain a deep and kind of fundamental meaning, and have to be more than entertaining if they're going to do their work. Now, we have in our Bible the two Genesis myths of the creation. The first one, which is by far the most recent, and the older one, which is in the second chapter and the third chapter, which talk about the Garden of Eden. What I have done here is to do my own retelling of the Garden of Eden story, which is radically different from the one that's in the Bible, isn't it? Or did you not notice the difference? I do that in the tradition of the Hebrew Haggadah. That's A-G-G-A-D-A. Now, you may, if you have had some contact with the Jewish tradition, have encountered a word with that's Haggadah. Haggadah is the elaboration of store of things around the
Torah.
No, but the season at Easter time, the Passover. The Haggadah goes back way, way beyond that, and it is a tradition that is sort of an extension of the Midrashic tradition of telling stories in order to explain things. The Haggadah goes back even farther than that, and it's a very lively kind of an art form that the rabbis tried to suppress lots of times because they played fast and loose with the tradition. They'd have Moses talking to King David and so forth. And the tradition has continued in our religious life. During the Middle Ages, the various craft guilds went around with their wagons and acted out various scenes from the Bible, and they played fast and loose also with the stories. They invented all the details, and the stories often came out quite different than they are in the Bible. But it was a way of getting in touch with their deep feelings about these things and learning what the essence of the story is. Now, getting back to the quest is the story of a hero, who may be male or female, who goes and against supreme odds does the heroic thing in order to achieve some purpose, some very lofty purpose. The King Arthur legends, for instance, and the chalice, the quest for the Holy Grail, the Hobbit stories. The mythology and the legends of our society is full of those things. And the Bible is one of those. The stories of the quest of people struggling against great odds to try and accomplish something. And the early books are full of those quest stories. The stories of Abraham and Sarah questing for the fulfillment of God's promise. The story of Jacob going from one place to another, trying on the quest to try and find reconciliation with God and his father and Esau. The quest of the Ruth and Naomi to try and find some kind of way to survive. These are all quests, and the quest of Jesus, of course, and Paul. The quest of going somewhere, moving along this heroic kind of struggle to
for some purpose that is greater than simply survival. Okay, I want to read you another story here, which is a different sort of a thing. And it's called Why Angels Can Fly. Okay. I am an angel. Now that's a bit of a stretch, I know. A guy with a beard and red suspenders, these are a little bit red, is definitely not the first image that pops into your mind when you think of angels. You think of those fat 5-year-old cherubs that Raphael put in his paintings, or Saint Michael, who looks like the Pope with wings. But a large-nosed, flat-footed, past his prime male in blue jeans and bifocals. Well, anyway, so expand your mind. Broaden your vision. Use your imagination. Take another look at the photo on the back cover. That's me, and I'm an angel. Red suspenders are part of my angel outfit. Red suspenders are Jake's favorite. Jake and his sister Zoe, my grandkids, are angels too, even though their mom and dad, who are also angels, doubt that occasionally. Everybody calls cute kids angels. It's been a while since anybody called me an angel. Old Devil is more likely, and describes me just as accurately as angel. I could write an essay twice as long as this one about the times I've screwed up or even been fundamentally evil. I know that, you know that, let's leave it at that. Besides, lots of religious traditions have bad angels in them, including the Christian tradition. You should never try to typecast us angels. Jake likes the red suspenders because he can pull them as far out as they go and then snap them back onto my belly. I overreact with great grandfatherly noises and Jake giggles. It's the kind of game angels play with each other. Angels like fun that requires no intelligence, but does require two people who love each other. The love is what makes the game work. It's the love that makes us ordinary humans into angels. I learned about angels reading a book by Rabbi Harold Kushner. In When Bad Things Happen to Good People, Rabbi Kushner has a wonderful fantasy about one of the creation legends in the Bible. But Jews believed in just one God. That was really important to the folks who collected the stories that went into the Bible. In the creation legend Rabbi Kushner is talking about, God makes the world and all the plants and animals and the birds and the bugs. Then God says, let us create humans in our image. Us? Our image? Who is God talking to in that legend? If the world has just been created and there is only one God and no people yet. The good rabbi grins and says, it must be the animals. God looks at the animals and said, let us make humans in our image, like you animals and like me, God. Biblical scholars had a cerebral hernia when the rabbi proposed that one, but who cares? It's a delightful idea, so it's so delightful it must be true. That's how I found out I was an angel. Angels are not as wonderful as God, but a whole lot more wonderful than animals. So if I, as a human, bear the characteristics of both my creator and of a crawfish, 50% God and 50% gorilla, the God part must be a little bit angelic, wouldn't you think? Tradition has it that when God becomes visible to humans, it's as an angel. And I am certainly visible. My doctor would like me to be about 40 pounds less visible. The angel part doesn't show all the time, of course, not even most of the time. But sometimes I am angelic. Yes, believe it. And so are you. When you and I are loving, the angel vibrations are turned up to high. When Zoe snuggles down into my arms and I sit there in the rocker feeling content as a cow in a cornfield, both Zoe and I are angels. When I do something good for someone else, or when I let someone else do something good to me, I am being an angel. So what's so unusual about that? Nothing at all. It means you are an angel, and so is everybody else, at least sometimes. I have a friend who is a cabinet minister in a provincial government. I believe he is doing his best, his level best, to be as just and caring and as fair as he can be in the thankless political arena. When he is doing his selfless best, he's an angel. When Louise next door brings over a tray of hot muffins, she's an angel. A few years ago, Bev and I came across a very confused woman sitting on the curb after midnight in her nightgown. She was disoriented and cold and badly in need of help. A few hours later, when the police came to help us and she was taken away to the hospital, she said, "You're an angel." "Nah," I said. But she was right, I was. And so was she, because in her confusion and extreme vulnerability, she brought out some of the best in us. I don't see that good part of me very often because I am so busy being important. There is an old tradition that tells us to pay attention to folks like that woman because you never know when you might be encountering an angel unawares. There are really no clear divisions. Imagine a line with God at one end and an amoeba at the other. In between you have, just below God, angels, humans, mammals, lower orders of animals, insects, and all the other tiny creepy crawlies that make up this exciting universe till you get to that amoeba. The divisions are relatively clear at the bottom end. But at the top, where you find God, angel, human, it is not clear where one ends and the other begins. If you go digging around through the world's religious literature, that just fuzzifies things. In my own Judeo-Christian tradition, the word angel comes from the Greek angelos, which is at the first simply meant messenger. The older Hebrew term, malak, basically means the same thing. In other words, whoever God uses to get in touch with us, that's an angel. My experience tells me that most often God communicates to me through other people. Occasionally, people have told me they feel God has communicated to them through me. That makes us angels. All the world's religious traditions have that wisdom about the divine nature of human. The Bhagavad Gita says, the Supreme Self dwells in every creature. Sikhism asks us to recognize God within yourself. Islam tells us that God's soul whispers within us, and that God is nearer to us than the jugular vein. My ideas about angels are old ideas that have been bopping around the heads of saints and seers for thousands of years. There's something wonderfully divine about us humans when we are at our best. That's when we become God's messengers, angels. And something frighteningly diabolical when we are at our worst. And then also we are angels, because traditionally, angels are not always good and sweet and wonderful. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, there are evil angels as well, and sometimes the bad angels and the good angels are the same people. I heard a story about a teacher who asked the children, if all the bad people were painted red and all the good people were painted green, what color would you be? Striped, answered a very wise child. I'm talking about the green stripes mostly, the times when we're acting out of the God side of our humanity, when we're dressed up in wings and halos. It is true that underneath the angel outfit we wear a suit of red underwear, and the thing that keeps the halo from slipping off are the horns underneath. We better not forget that. One way to tell the difference between good angels and not good angels is that the good angels love to laugh. Angel laughter is a very special kind of laughter. It's the kind of laughter I get from Jake when he snaps my red suspenders. It's the kind of chortle I get from Zoe when I make rude noises with my lips on her neck.
It's the laughter of pure joy, of love that is not deserved or earned, but simply given and received. That's why angels can fly. Even flat-footed, gray-haired, bifocal, red-suspended angels. We can fly because we take ourselves lightly. So, what does it feel like to be angels? Is that comfort? Are you comfortable with that?
Encouraging.
It's encouraging? Why, Jonathan?
Becoming a Lutheran guild.
What makes you think that's Lutheran? It's almost all Christians have, Catholic and Protestant have a great gobs of guilt that they have to wrestle with all the time. And one of the things that can help in that wrestling is to recognize that others have wrestled with this guilt before us. One of the things that I am astounded by here is how that I find myself knowing a lot more about Lutheranism than an awful lot of Lutherans around here, and I'm not even a member of the Lutheran Church. And I wonder why it is that you spend so little time digging around in your stories.
There's more interesting subjects.
Well, maybe there are. But the story of Martin Luther himself is a very interesting story. He was a very complex individual. I mean, he was not all sort of dressed up in a suit of shining celestial armor. He had his bad side too. But he is a very interesting person, and he was a very courageous person and found himself on a quest. What do you see as the quest? What was the quest that he was on? Just to become the head of a new church? So what was he struggling for? Why? Pardon me?
He was going to change things in those 95 pieces that he thought were wrong.
Mm-hmm. This thesis, you said?
Yeah.
Because I heard of one student who wrote an exam paper, what did Luther do? And the answer was that he nailed his theses to this cathedral door.
On a quest for his own personal salvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why?
Because he hadn't found it.
He hadn't found it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you identify at all, any of you, with the quest of Martin Luther? Have any of you ever, and I don't expect that you answer this question if you don't want to, but have any of you ever suffered from depression? Mm-hmm. Martin Luther had a terrible time with depression. Constipation was another one of his problems. Well, yes, sometimes they do, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me read you a story. It was a hot, sultry, late afternoon in July. The year was 1505. 21-year-old Martin Luther saw the thunder clouds roll in overhead. He shuddered in fear each time another bolt of lightning detonated across the sky. "Saint Anne, preserve me," he prayed under his breath. Then the lightning struck closer, and each time the prayer was louder, "Saint Anne, preserve me." Then a bolt of lightning shattered a tree within a few feet of where he walked. Smoke billowed, his hair literally stood on end from the electricity in the air, and young Martin Luther screamed, "Saint Anne, preserve me, spare my life, and I will give myself to God. I will become a monk." But the life of a monk brought no peace. In the darkness of the night, young Martin fought the bitter depression, the Anfechtungen, he called those times of blackness. He fought the depression, and he fought the chronic constipation, the physical and spiritual sense that his body was holding, oh boy, what am I done here? This is the trouble of reading this.
The spiritual sense that his body was holding into himself all the evil from his darkest thoughts. God was punishing him for his sin, he was sure. So Martin prayed harder and fasted longer and mortified his body and became the best, most pious monk in his order. He was told to study and enter the priesthood, and obediently he went. But as Brother Martin became Father Martin and celebrated his first Mass, he stood there terrified at the thought that he, a sinner, would dare address himself to God. It was all he could do to quell the fear enough to finish the Mass. And when it was over, he ran back to his room to pray, to strain, to struggle, to relieve the congestion in his heart and in his bowels. Martin Luther studied harder. He worked harder. He was brilliant and successful and famous, but his nights were full of dark despair and fear as the Anfechtungen and his own bowels refused to set him free. He lectured at the prestigious university at Wittenberg, lectured on Paul's letter to the Romans, and there a single verse caught his attention. He'd seen it before many times, of course, but this time it seemed to focus his attention in a way that it had never done before. The just shall live by faith. He ignored the verse at first, then found it there in front of the mind in his midnight battles with depression and constipation. The just shall live by faith, said the verse, but Martin rebelled. We earn our way, we study our way into the love of God, he shouted. But the word from St. Paul would not go away, till one day he was surprised to hear himself say the phrase quite softly. He said it gently to himself, again and again, and then he said it gently to God. The just shall live by faith. And with that word, Martin Luther heard the words of the risen Christ to his disciples. Don't be afraid. Reach out and touch me. Don't be afraid. And now the words became more personal. Do not be afraid, Martin. A song began to form, first in Martin's heart, then on his lips, and later on in paper. Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. Did we in our own strength confide, our striving would be losing. Were not the right man on our side, a man of God's own choosing. Just shall live by faith, Martin shouted into the darkness of the night. The just shall live by faith. And in that moment, the darkness lifted from his soul. The night no longer held him captive. His bowels moved with a great and wondrous thunder, and the Protestant Reformation was underway. I've done this with groups of people who thought I was very insulting to Luther to bring up the problem of his bowels. Do you feel that way, anyone?
No.
If he hadn't fasted so much, he wouldn't have had the bowel problem.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Do any of you find yourselves identifying with Luther at all in that story? Have you ever been frightened by God? They're really talking to a group, you know, John. They were talking more to you, I think, than they were to me, aren't they?
Yeah, sometimes by the, I don't know if this is by God or by the elements with tornadoes. Mm-hmm. Is that by God?
Well, I don't know, is it?
I think he controls it.
One of the things that I wrote into this study, into this story, was the assumption that Martin Luther didn't do this by careful analysis and so forth, that it was essentially a revelation. Now, Luther was noted as being a very great scholar, even before, you know, from right from the very beginning. He was
very well respected as a scholar, but I didn't have this as a scholarly thing. Do you think that's wrong? You don't think so? Why, Don?
I think he, you know, it was a question of courage and conviction. And I'm just wondering how we, you know, we don't sit, do you sit as Lutherans and think about what we think about him?
You don't?
It's kind of a non-topic.
So why do you call yourselves Lutherans?
Always have.
Huh?
At Reformation time, I think about him.
Yeah.
Once a year.
And we believe we're saved by grace and not by good works.
The other day I was wearing the t-shirt which had the Latin version of one of Luther's very famous statements. It said, "You are a sinner, therefore sin boldly." But there's more to it. Jonathan was wearing it on his t-shirt, the whole thing. And you got that memorized, right?
No.
Well, there is more to the statement. You can't take that kind of a statement out of context without playing with it, without doing violation into it. Because he didn't just to say, "You are a sinner, therefore sin boldly," doesn't give us license to go out and do whatever we want. He was saying that we are sinners. That is a sort of a fact. We're going to mess up. There's no way we can get around that. Now, therefore, recognizing that, go ahead with life. Go ahead with an enthusiastic life, knowing that you're going to mess up some more, but rely on the grace of God to forgive you while you mess up. That is a wonderful, liberating statement. Lutheran should be the most liberated denomination in the Protestant community.
All you've got is guilt.
All you've got is guilt. So where did you get that from?
From my mother.
From your mother. Yes. We all got that. I got it from my mother and my father, too, who always preached me little sermons, you know. Like, for instance, we had Rudyard Kipling's poem, If, framed in a little thing on his wall. And do you remember how that goes? If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, and so forth. And I don't remember the middle part, but it goes, if you can do something about heart and mind and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and something
or other.
Yes. And if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and what is more, you'll be a man, my son. Well, I find it way too much work to be a man in that kind of a context. But that's really not the point of what we're talking about here. We're talking about the way people learn things and how they find this quest. A number of years ago, when Bev was the minister at the West Bank Church where we live, we were at a camp right on Okanagan Lake. Okanagan Lake is very similar in many ways to Lake Chelan, long and deep, and we were on a camp on the shore of this thing, and it was a congregational camp. And on the Saturday night, they were having a campfire. And across down the lake, we saw a thunderstorm developing. And it started moving across. Now, this was just when dusk was beginning to fall. They had sung the camp songs, all those dumb songs you sing at camp. And the 9-year-old boys had put on their stupid skits, and everybody had laughed and so forth. The fire was beginning to blaze, and a kind of a quiet seemed to settle on the group. And there was one young boy who didn't have a lap to sit on. His mother's lap was already taken up by a younger sibling, so he came and sat on my lap. And I sat there with that child on my lap, and the whole group became wonderfully quiet as this thunderstorm came down the lake.
and the lightning detonated, and for a moment it would light up the entire landscape, and you would see it all, and then it would be dark again. And during one of those lightning strikes, I happened to be looking at the face of this child, and I saw an expression of awe. For that moment, I saw a truly wonderful expression of what awe is. It's a word I can never define, but I will always know that from that moment of seeing that child's face. And revelation is something like that kind of, we have these moments when we see everything clearly and then we forget. How many of you have read the children's story, Watership Down? Yes. There is a beautiful part in there where the otter and the toad, I think it is, go looking for go looking for the otter child who has gone missing. And they go and they follow a strange kind of liquid music until they find, all of a sudden they are seated, they find themselves in the company of the great god Pan. And they are afraid, but the god Pan is looking after the otter child and turns the otter child over to them. And then they leave. And then the line goes, and then the great god Pan offered animals, and that is the gift of forgetfulness, because no small animal could ever live with the reality of the truth that is there. Stories are one way of shining that kind of light. Just for a moment, when you hear these stories, if you allow them to have their way with you, then sometimes lights go on. Okay, I want to read you one more story here, which is about those kind of lights going on. Well, here we are. And these are all true incidents. The first story wasn't. But this one is. Years ago, my parents lived in the Tuxedo area, not far from the Winnipeg Zoo. One day, Mum was looking out of the window. "Henry," she said, "there's a buffalo on our front lawn." Dad was understandably skeptical. "Are you all right, Marie?" "Of course I'm all right," she said. "I'm telling you, there's a buffalo on our front lawn." And there was. It was a big buffalo bull, and it had escaped from the zoo. But for a while, Dad wondered if Mum had flipped her lid. It was just too crazy to believe. But there it was, munching on his grass. Years later in Calgary, we had a bunch of hot air balloons floating over the city. There was some kind of competition or convention or whatever it is when hot air balloonists get together to go ballooning. But the balloonists, it seems, are not always totally sure where they are going to land. Now, this all sounds like a very wonderful and undeveloped metaphor, some of it for a sermon or something. But anyway, Mom, come and look, shouted a five-year-old who lived just down the street from us. There's a balloon in our backyard. His mom knew her five-year-old tended to have a vivid imagination. "Yes, I'm sure there is, Eric," she said, and she kept right on with her work. "No, Mom, really, honest, there's a big red yellow balloon in our backyard." And there was. Balloons and buffaloes in people's yards are too improbable to believe, but sometimes they are true. A god head over heels in love with creation is too improbable to believe. But women who gaze out of the narrow windows of life will believe. So will children dreaming in their backyards. And who knows, maybe even an aged, jaded writer. How do you know when God speaks to you? Has God ever spoken to you? How do you know when God speaks to you? If I came up and said to you, you know, God just told me something, just this minute, would you think I was a little bit, you know?
Sometimes you don't know until after.
Uh-huh. Say more about that.
Well, that's it. You just have probably a moment of truth, and then afterwards you realize, oh, that was God speaking, but you don't always recognize it at the time.
How do you know it was God speaking?
I think because you did the most inner sense of peace that you've ever had.
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear you.
The most inner sense of peace.
A sense of peace.
Mm-hmm. An intense peace. Not one that comes from quietness, but a very intense peace.
Okay. Have you ever had God come and tell you to get off your butt and do some good in the world?
Well, yeah, I'm sure I have. Mm-hmm. Maybe not in those words, but a feeling.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
To do. Yeah.
How? What kind of? What context do these words come to you in? I mean, like, how do you know it's not just your own imagination?
Well, I guess for me, it's a lot stronger than what my imagination. You know, I get it's more. It's a lot stronger drive than what I would have myself as a human.
Sometimes it's repeated.
Who said that? Oh, okay, yeah. It's repeated over and over again?
Yeah, it comes.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll say something and I'll go, wow, where did that come from? And then I realize that it wasn't from myself that it was coming from.
Does it come as a statement or as an experience?
Maybe both. Sometimes I've said something to other people, they'll ask me a question about something, and I'll answer their question, and I'll think, where did that come from? I know it did come from me. So sometimes I think it is a statement, and sometimes I think it's experiences.
A friend, a very close friend of mine, who's also a writer, he says God doesn't speak English. Of course, Lutherans have always known that God speaks German, right?
Norwegian.
Well, Jim would say he doesn't speak Norwegian or German or Swedish or any other language. God does not speak in words. God speaks in experiences. Speaks to us through experiences where something happens in our life, and as we ruminate on that and reflect on that and live with it, through that comes the sense that God is moving you.
What does he say to the whole Bible then?
Well,
God's word.
Well,
what he says to people.
Pardon me?
What he says to people.
In the Bible?
Yeah.
Well, he says it in Hebrew there, yes. Except that he is, the Hebrew is, this is the reflection of people on experiences they have had of God with them. The Hebrew experience is more reflecting on their experiences and retelling the story. Yes?
I believe that God speaks to me through the sacrament of baptism and Holy Communion. Mm-hmm.
But those are experiences, aren't they?
Yes, as against what?
Mm-hmm.
They are experiences, and they are words, too.
Yeah. Yes, but they the sacraments are enacted beliefs. Have you ever been to a communion where there were no words? There's a Lutheran pastor by the name of Floyd Schaefer who has made a career of doing clown work, and he celebrates clown communions. Have any of you ever experienced that? I don't. You have? Yeah. An interesting time for us, many years ago, there was at a center very much like this, up north from here, we did a week-long seminar on clowning. This was led by an RC priest from the Seattle area and a woman who was his assistant. And we learned the fine art of clowning in the liturgical context. Now, I don't have time to go into all of that, but I want to tell you an experience out of that. At the end of the event, we were going to celebrate a clown communion. The clown communion goes on without any words at all, only actions. Now, the problem was that this was to be celebrated. The person who was doing the main work in this was to be that RC priest, except he came down with a terrible case of the flu, and he had to stay very, very close to his bathroom. So the rest of us decided to go on with this anyway, and we had no experience of this at all. Then when we got these 500 or so people assembled in this gymnasium, the signal for the various kinds of things and the order in which they were to happen was to be a tape that played the music, except somebody put on the wrong tape. And none of us knew what we were doing, and the whole thing turned out into an awful schlamazel. Everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong. And then something began to change, and the people who were church people, much like you are, began to take that over for themselves. And the communion began to happen in 100 little ways as people celebrated with each other. An hour after that, I had a conversation with a friend that I've known for many years, and she told me that both her husband and her son had found this deeply moving. Her husband is head of psychiatry at the University of Calgary. Her son has Down syndrome. And both of them found that moment meaningful. So the point is, I think, there's a cute commercial playing in our area. Esso. Do you have Esso gasoline down here?
Exxon.
Pardon me?
Exxon.
Well, the same sort of thing. It's an Esso commercial. It's cute, but it's sad. We hear a child saying, "Grandpa, you always come to Esso, don't you?" "Been coming here for years," says Grandpa. "Then I know why," says the boy. Now, Grandpa should have asked the child's opinion, but instead he babbles on about friendly service and all that sort of crap. "But did you ever see a tiger?" The boy wants to get right back into the real issue. And the picture shows a cartoon figure of a tiger smiling at the boy through the window. "Oh, I'm too old to see tigers," Grandpa says very kindly. "Do you see tigers?" The boy then does what any small grandpa-admiring boy will do. "I'm too old to see tigers," he says, even as he tenderly, sadly touches the hand of the tiger against the glass of the window, of the car window. The boy knows that if he is to become a man like his grandpa, the tiger must go. As commercials go, it is certainly one of the least offensive, and there is a tenderness to it that is refreshing. The truth is that Grandpa and Esso really can't see tigers. Small boys can, but old boys like grandpas and big corporations soon convince them that imaginary tigers don't exist. So small boys stop seeing them. I feel sad every time I see that commercial. I feel sad because children are taught not to value or to believe the richness of their own God-given imagination. The hard-nosed, no-nonsense, business-is-business attitude we instill in our children robs them of a way of seeing, robs them of the ability to see beyond the obvious, beyond the measurable, into the mind of God. And our children grow up spiritually handicapped. It's not a modern phenomenon. Jesus encountered tiger-denying grandfathers and oil company advertising people too. He called them scribes and Pharisees. So Jesus picked up a child and said, unless you become like this child who knows about imaginary tigers, all you will see is just another gas station, and you will never know the truth that lies behind the facts. So Jesus gathered some friends, men and women who had not lost their childhood eyes, so that when they faced the fact of his execution, when they faced a love-denying world, they would remember him saying, you will see tigers. One of the gifts that Bev and I have had over the past years is the gift of two grandchildren. And we can brag and boast with the best of them, but what they have mostly done for us is to help us see life through the eyes of children again. And if we can manage that, then sometimes we will know that we are hearing or experiencing or knowing the love of God or the life of God. To become like a child is to let yourself move into those wonderful stories and into that sense of being open that allows God to speak into our hearts. And then we can read those magnificent stories in the Bible and in them find God speaking to us. But first we have to come to them like a child and be open to those stories and be open to that truth. Thank you.
Thank you.